Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. Jeff, if I may call you Jeff, this is a pleasure to have you at Haldane's today. And what we're planning to do, if it's okay with you, is just to have a conversation between two people that, in my calculation, have spent about 100 years plying our way through the law.
Well, pleasure to be here this morning, and thank you for inviting me, Jonathan, from one old man to another.
Yes. What I thought we could do was start off a little bit by reminiscing, because in fact you and I, well, in your case, reunited with Hong Kong in, I think it was 1980.
Yes.
And I came to Hong Kong as a very young man, obviously, in 1978, at the beginning of 1978. And we're still here today, of course. So we've got an awful lot of history. Seriously, we've got an awful lot of history. And we've gone through perhaps Hong Kong's most interesting times.
Indeed, I think we have. Been an interesting life, let's say, in the law.
And speaking for myself, and I know it's true of you too, we've not regretted it one bit.
Not at all. The only regret is that it's passed so quickly, but a lot of things have happened in those many years.
Now, I thought we could actually explore a little bit for our listeners what the law really means as a lawyer and also from the perspective of the public. But let's just start, as we should, at the beginning, because I think it's right to say that while you have had a very illustrious career as a lawyer and, of course, as a Chief Justice, which was the pinnacle of the legal profession, it's also true to say that when you started off, you would have quite liked to have been a historian.
Well, that was the position before I went into university. You were thinking of what to do at university. I did history at A-levels and loved it. I still do, actually. I still love history. So I thought about doing history until my father said, well, you know, you've got to think about what you're going to do after history. In those days, when you're 18, you don't think that far ahead. And it was due to my elder brother, who's a doctor here, who said to me, well, why don't you think about law? You can't do medicine or anything scientifically orientated.
Why not, Geoffrey?
Well, because I didn't do a science subject at A-level. I did history, I did German, and I did French. So that doesn't qualify you to become a scientist or a doctor. So he said, why don't you think about law? We had no lawyers in the family, so I looked it up, seemed interesting, and before you know it, that's what I applied to do.
Life has its own way, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and it's been lucky.
Just anecdotally say that I was a little bit the same. My father was threatening me with all sorts of weird ways of making a living, and I said, none of those sound too good. He said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll fix you up with a day in an estate agent's office and a day in a solicitor's office, pals of mine. And the estate agent's office didn't appeal. And the solicitor's office, I found thrilling. And it was a fellow called Peter Fringrad, who went on to become a judge. He was with a firm called Willie Hargraves that don't exist anymore. And he whisked me to Wakefield Magistrates Court. We went to the cells, and then he did his thing in court. And then we went off to the Leeds Club for lunch. And then he saw a new client in the afternoon. I came home and said to Dad, that's what I want to do. But I got a terrible shock, Jeff. He told me I had to pass some exams to do it. So there we are. So we both drifted into the law, and happily so. And of course, in your early days, you were a barrister.
Yes.
And I think if we could fast forward, when you left the bar and became a judge, your last brief involved us in some way. I can't remember whether we were instructing you or we were against us, but I think your last brief was...
Well, that's right. It was for the government. I'd been doing some work for the government, mainly in constitutional cases, which was not my practice before I had taken silk. Yes, it was, I think, against your firm. It was a case which ended up in the Court of Final Appeal. My last involvement was in the Court of Appeal, and it's not frightfully interesting unless you're actually involved in it, which was whether how to clock up your 7 years in order to attain permanent resident status in Hong Kong. And this poor chap had been here 7 years, but unfortunately for him, he'd also been in prison.
And the question was, did it count?
Did it count or did it not count? No, I don't think it did. Or rather, at least that's what I argued. I think it was reversed in the Court of Final Appeal.
They were kind.
But then I was no longer in the case.
Right.
So I can blame not my predecessor, but I can blame my successor.
All right. Let's do that. And now tell me, I know a number of barristers that became judges, and I know the struggle for some of them about making that move over, because it's a big change from being a barrister earning your living to being a judge with all that that entails. Was it a struggle for you, or was it an easy transition?
It was made easier because the then Chief Justice, my predecessor, Chief Justice Andrew Lee, wanted to ask me whether I wanted to join the judiciary. He encouraged me to do so, but he said, before you make a decision to say yes, you make sure you and your family are 100% behind this, because if you have any doubt at all, please do not apply, because the worst thing that can happen is that you regret a decision. And those words stuck by me, so that once I made up my mind to become a judge, not only is it a case of having made up my own bed, you accept it, and most important of all, you try to enjoy that new occupation.
Because you can't go back, of course.
You can't go back, no. It's a strange system, actually, in Hong Kong, as it is in England, that you train all your life to become something, that is, a lawyer. You stop becoming a lawyer to be a judge, but you can never go back to the very profession you've trained up for.
Right.
And that seems an oddity to a lot of people, and that's why in many jurisdictions, of course, you can return. I, of course, know the thinking behind not being able to return, and it's a good logic.
Yeah. Now, again, fast forwarding, you became Chief Justice in 2010, and I know from listening to an LSE speech you made that it was suggested that you became the Chief Justice in changing times, and that, and I'm going to quote you, the judiciary was led, and that's by you, of course, by an amazing leader in turbulent times, but also that you were a warm and kind man. I got that from the LSE. Do you remember that speech?
I do remember, yes. It was well attended, actually, for a student gathering.
Well, I listened to it, and I thought, by the way, that the way they introduced you, and I've just quoted from the way they introduced you, was rather nice. Yeah, I'm sure you enjoyed it, and I'm sure it was well meant and indeed very much deserved, because I've always observed you to be a warm and kind man, if I may say so. And the reason I say that in particular is not to blow you up, as it were, but to say, how does that fit in, that warmth and kindness, to being a judge? Because I've never been a judge. Nobody has ever asked me to be so. But I would turn it down because I would have a tremendous difficulty making decisions that can affect people's lives enormously.
Yes, I think the starting point, I mean, the modern word which is used is empathy. I don't use that word because what applies to a judge is that you are able, in the words of that famous book, To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch says, what you've got to do is put yourself in the skin of another person whose fate you have to decide if you're a judge, whose wealth you have to decide as a judge. You put yourself in his skin and walk around in his shoes. That's a long, slightly bombastic way of saying that you've got to respect other people's rights and, more important, their feelings. Once you adopt that attitude, as you should in real life, not just in the courtroom, in real life, that is a good start for you to make the right decision, and most important of all, if you're a judge, a fair decision. That is the starting point.
Yes, yes. And when you became Chief Justice, of course, there genuinely were turbulent times because we had the umbrella movement and the blockage of all the main arteries, the roads in Hong Kong. And was that a time that troubled you as a judge, or was that the independence of the judiciary a comfortable position to be in so that you could observe it without it affecting your formal position as Chief Justice?
Well, it was not a comfortable time. It was a highly pressured time because you have to make a decision one way or the other, particularly if you're in the final court. The buck really does stop with you. And when the buck stops with you, you've got to make a decision. And then, of course, in law, it's worse than a football match. In a football match, at least you get a draw or a score draw. In deciding a case, it's either win or lose. It's because of that that there is pressure on a judge, and it was on me. But at no stage, I think, did I feel stress. And the reason for that is not because I'm superhuman or anything like that. It's because you tell yourself, do the best you can, weigh up all the options, don't skimp, do your research, have everything before you, and then make a decision and stick by it. Now, with hindsight, it may or may not be the right one, but it is something that you've thought through and you've done your best. And you would also say, I defy anyone to do any better than that, because, as we all know, it's a cliche, nobody's perfect.
Right. And, of course, the umbrella movement, as it became known, the blockage of the roads and the sit-in, we didn't know it at the time, of course, but it was actually a picnic compared with what was to come up in 2019. So they were genuinely turbulent times. And one of the interesting features of that, Jeff, was the fact that we became under pressure, ironically perhaps, from London, because the time came when London was suggesting that overseas judges, the non-permanent judges and other foreign judges, non-Chinese judges sitting in the courts here, should not be involved in Hong Kong anymore. And you and I, in fact, with others, took part in a debate, a webinar, and I checked, it was apparently the 5th of May 2021. You recall that?
Yes, I recall. It was soon after I had retired.
Yes. We had Lord Charlie Faulkner, yes, arguing that, in fact, it was right that English judges, at least, should withdraw from Hong Kong. It was Jonathan Kaplan, QC in those days, not KC yet, suggesting that, in fact, it was in Hong Kong's best interest that foreign judges were still part of the judiciary. And I was there arguing the same, that it was a good thing for Hong Kong. You were no longer Chief Justice, I realised, but they were genuinely troubling times for Hong Kong. It was a really changing judicial landscape with criticism from, ironically, as I say, from London rather than Beijing.
Yes. Not from the activities that had to be dealt with, whether or not there were criminal activities and so on, and there were sort of civil aspects as well. The arguments and the debate which raged on were difficult ones because, not for the first time, politics and political considerations, and later, and this actually applies now, geopolitical considerations entered into the equation. And that, actually, without seeming offensive, contaminates the debate, which should purely be one about the law and the rule of law, which includes the functioning of the judiciary. That's what I'm concerned with. It's when politics enter the fray that the debate loses a discipline, loses a structure, and becomes slightly, I'm afraid, all in. And that's the difficult part in terms of debating. The practical side I've just mentioned, which is having to deal with these matters. Of course, having dealt with these matters, the courts then come under criticism from one side or the other, just taking a criminal context, whether the court quits or convicts, you will be under heavy criticism. And that heavy criticism, on the whole, actually, I would say 99% would derive from political consideration.
And it's not just Hong Kong. In fact, Hong Kong's been relatively free of political comment, I think. If you think back, Jeff, over the years, you don't find politicians here making overt criticism of decisions. They may have different views to the reach by the judge, but they're pretty silent on the matter. But if you look overseas, America particularly at the moment, and England at times, Boris Johnson, for example, on the roguing of Parliament, where they've been very vocal against judicial decisions. So it strikes me as being rather better at separating the politics from the judiciary.
Perhaps on the whole, but there were quite a few politicians who did hold back in Hong Kong in terms of criticizing decisions of the judiciary. There was one person, who shall obviously remain nameless, who one day praised the judiciary for upholding the rule of law because he got a decision which he liked. I think it was a conviction. Only to turn a few weeks later, when the courts acquitted or allowed an appeal, I can't remember which, to say that the rule of law had been seriously undermined and damaged. And this was not just one person. A few people did that. So, no, there are politicians in Hong Kong who let their feelings become known. I'm not ascribing any bad faith or anything like that, but it is an argument which arises from political considerations and influences rather than, as I say, what ought to be purely legal ones. And the legal question, by the way, is this: is the rule of law being upheld by the courts, or has it been upheld by the courts in any decision? That is the question, and it is not a political question.
No, quite right. But I wonder why it is that in the last few years, never mind Hong Kong just for a moment, but why it has become so much more prevalent, particularly in the United States at the moment, where there's a lot of questioning of politicians, questioning the decisions from the courts and the way in which life should be led in the United States by politicians. And also, as I say, in England, particularly over the Brexit issues, I mean, that was pretty unique. What is it about society, you think, that's becoming more aggressive about the way in which courts behave?
Well, I think over the years, and this applies to Hong Kong, people have become more interested in matters which affect society in general and them in particular, and they take a view on that, and they rightly are entitled to an opinion, but their opinion derives either from their individual circumstances or from their political leanings. And that is why you get this reaction, sometimes extremely strong, to what the courts do, because what the courts do actually is often public news. I mean, of course, over 90% of the matters dealt with judiciary will not be interesting to people. Nobody's interested in the sale of goods.
No.
Nobody's interested even in how equitable principles apply to this or that situation. But they are interested, of course, when matters which are sensitive are dealt with by the courts. And none more, let's just take an obvious example, none more so than cases dealing with the national security law.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, national security law has been something that Hong Kong was expected to pass way back before the handover in 1997.
It's in the basic law, yep,
yeah,
as well.
Yes, absolutely. And yet it has caused friction.
Yes. I mean, if you take away the political part, and I'm not sure you can, because a lot of what you read in the press, especially overseas, about the national security law and from governments and comments from governments, you know, six-month reports and so on, human rights in Hong Kong, they come from a political standpoint.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is their position. But if you take away all that and just look at it, people are interested, people in Hong Kong and elsewhere are interested in the notion, well, actually, is the enforcement of the national security law by the courts done by an institution which is not a court anymore, but somehow, this is the criticism you hear overseas, which is an arm of the government in implementing a policy which seeks, for example, to curb free speech and so on and so forth. That's why people are interested in that aspect of
it. Yes.
And that's the hurdle, the challenge which faces the judiciary.
Yes. And of course, the truth of the matter is that the courts in Hong Kong are still open to the public. In other words, any hearing, or nearly any hearing, there are one or two exceptions, but they're very exceptional, are open to the public, which is a good sign in terms of the administration of law.
Oh, absolutely, because the vital question I was about to say for the judiciary is, does the judiciary provide an independent and impartial tribunal to adjudicate on the legal rights or liabilities of others? And for that to do its work, because again, as I said, it's black and white, is either in a criminal case guilty or not guilty, in order to have confidence in that institution, the judiciary, to deliver, it's got to convince. And the starting point, Jonathan, you're absolutely right, is what you do transparent to the people who take an interest in it. And this is very important. Hearings, including hearings involved with the NSL, it's the same as any other sort of law, really. Hearings are open to the public. So that's one half of the equation.
Yeah.
The second half is that when a decision is made, you know exactly the reasons for that decision, because they are published not just to the relevant parties, but to the world in general. So when you criticize or not criticize the judiciary for decisions made, you have the luxury, if you choose to make use of it, you have the luxury of reading exactly what the reasons are. You can be convinced or not convinced, but they have bared their souls, as it were, for you, for the world, to criticize.
In the judgment, your late night reading.
It's far too long. I mean, this is one of the worst things for students. They spend hours and hours reading judgments.
Yes.
And they complain about their length. But one thing to be said about length, at least they've erred on the side of exposing every element of their reasoning to arrive at that important decision. And actually, I can think of no public institution that goes to such pains to explain a decision which impacts on the community.
And of course, we still have a full appeal system.
Well, that's right. So on the more limited basis, the judgment will enable the disgruntled or the losing party to appeal. And in Hong Kong, you've got to bear in mind, it's a double appellate layer. You can at least get to the Court of Appeal, and if certain circumstances arise, to the Court of Final Appeal.
Yes. And the Court of Final Appeal over the years has received a lot of praise for doing a wonderful job in Hong Kong, and I suspect you'd endorse that point of view.
Yes, I think so, because the court comes up with judgments which are of high quality. And that's not a boastful thing to say, because it ranks quite nicely alongside those common law jurisdictions, the well-known common law jurisdictions that every student is aware of. Those in Australia, of course, the United Kingdom, Canada, and so on.
Yes, yes. Well, from my side of the profession as a solicitor, I have to say that we've always been impressed with the Court of Final Appeal. But I suppose we should mention, because obviously they are difficult times, the resignation of Lord Sumption.
Yes.
With it, which was made rather publicly, and he explained his position. Do you have a thought to express on that?
Well, Lord Sumption, Jonathan Sumption, is a dear friend of mine. He remains a dear friend. He had, of course, his reason, which he's explained, articulated publicly. I don't want to, of course, enter into a war of words with him. What is more important is, of course, what it is that is said he was suggesting. And the part which, of course, bothers me the most, I don't think he, of course, intends this, but this, as I say, is what is said to be the effect of what he, of his resignation, is this, that there is a question mark over the independence or impartiality of the Hong Kong judiciary. And this ties in with what I said a little earlier about the enforcement of national security law. And that is the part which, of course, bothers me. I don't think he was suggesting anything along those lines, but that is what is being suggested. I, of course, always say this. If you are of the view that the Hong Kong courts are not impartial, are not independent, that is worrying, because instantly a community would lose confidence in the ability of the judiciary to do what its job is. So in order to understand or try to analyze whether the judiciary is still independent or impartial, you've got to go through a series of objective tests, if you like, in order to try to establish that. You've mentioned one already, Jonathan, and that is what the courts do transparent, so that whatever they do can be analyzed, and analyzed to bits, as they often are, is that out in the open, because as opposed to a closed hearing. There are other factors which come into it. For example, what is the caliber of judges? What are the qualifications for judges? What is the process of selecting judges? And so on. All these are important factors.
And in fact, Lord Sumption was careful to indicate that he was confident that the judges in Hong Kong are genuine common law independent judges. I think if I read his resignation reasons correctly, it was more the overall atmosphere in Hong Kong, the idea that national security law had enveloped everything. It was so much in the news.
Yes.
It was an overall tide that would wash over judges and affect them, rather than anything specific about their independence.
That's right. So the difference of opinion really is fairly narrow. And
yes.
Of course, Jonathan Sumption's come to his view. It's not the view that I would have come to if I were in his position. But then that's the beauty of having a division of opinion. But fundamentally, I don't think there is that much of a difference in thinking what is the right way and the right way of analysing.
Correct. And moreover, of course, we're in a jurisdiction which published his views.
Yes.
I mean, they weren't hidden.
That's right. It's quite open. You can disagree with it. You can even disagree vehemently. And that is the beauty of it. At least it is out in the open for people to debate, as you and I are doing right now.
Yes, we're not afraid to debate it.
Well,
that's the point.
That's right. And it's sensible and it's right that we should be able to debate it.
Yes, yes. And lastly on that, perhaps, he indicated that he wasn't making a final judgment because he recognised that there were courts above that were going to make the final judgment on the issues that he was troubled by.
And that would be the ultimate test in relation to this case or that case. You look at what the courts ultimately decide. You look at their reasoning, because I've said it's available to you to analyze, and then come to your own view, looked at sensibly, armed with all the arguments and materials you should be in order to answer the vital question, is the rule of law being upheld in Hong Kong by the court?
Yes, yes. Can I change tack just slightly? I'm familiar with a number of people, and I think you're one of them actually, that are involved in arbitration. And I heard an expression of this concern that sometimes arbitration may be growing as an industry, if I can call it an industry for shorthand, but it's extrajudicial. In other words, it's outside the court system. And therefore, the independence of the arbitrator is dependent on the character of the arbitrator himself. In other words, there may be some arbitrators that are lured by the fees and their judgment in relation to the case is affected by that. Do you have some thoughts on that topic? I throw it in because it's in the general mix of how the systems work in all jurisdictions, not specifically Hong Kong, but because we're in Hong Kong, it's obviously of more interest to us and our listeners.
I've given a number of lectures and talks on this point. Of course, what arbitrators do, they're not entirely immune from the court looking at it because the court does have a limited but important supervisory role in making sure that what the parties have had is a fair hearing. That said, one of the principal pillars of arbitration, commercial arbitration, is what is called party autonomy. That means that the parties have decided on this way of resolving disputes, arbitration, and it's sort of hands off by the court and no right of appeal. Now, I recall again what Andrew Lee said to me, not about arbitration, my predecessor. He sat me down before I became Chief Justice, after I'd been nominated and approved, and he said to me, look, I'm going to be frank with you. As Chief Justice, you've got to up your game. You've got to really do more than what you expect of yourself. And those were wise words, and these words apply to arbitrators. It is not a coincidence now, or rather it is a fact, that commercial disputes of massive figures, you know, a normal claim is hundreds of millions of US dollars and so on. With that sort of responsibility, arbitrators have got to up their game and realize, as I've often maintained, still maintain, they are part of the administration of justice. They must also demonstrate their impartiality and independence. This is obvious from all the forms you have to sign before you take on an arbitration, but you've got to live the reality as well. The reality must reflect the theory, and you mustn't be swayed by commercial considerations. I know arbitrators are paid. Of course they are. But you've got to put that out of your mind and act independently and fairly to both sides.
Do they?
I think on the whole they do. I sometimes wonder on the odd occasion whether something has motivated an arbitrator other than what should be the simple fact of applying the law to the facts and doing it impartially and fairly. Sometimes, you know, I have a moment, but thankfully not often. But that's not to say that arbitrators must not actually up their game. They must.
It has grown, hasn't it? The arbitration system has grown in the last 10 years here.
Absolutely. And although the courts have a limited role, the reality, as I always tell people, is that if the courts smell something which is not so pleasant, it will act on it.
Yeah. In the round, then, the growth of arbitration is helpful to the public?
Oh, yes. I think without a doubt it is. There is a lot, of course, of improvement that can be made. You just can't be complacent. And you can't just throw up your arms and say, well, nothing's perfect, so I may as well stop trying harder. No, you've got to, as I say, up your game.
Jeff, we're in the law business. That's what we've been in for the last 50 years each, roughly speaking. Are we happy with the way that Hong Kong's shaping up? Now, I'm not so much thinking about the stuff we've discussed in the last half an hour or so, but in terms of speed of delivery, digitalization, being modern, looking after people's needs, both in the criminal courts and, of course, in the civil and commercial courts. Are we up to speed, or is competitive jurisdictions like Singapore taking a lead in that regard?
Well, you mentioned Singapore. Singapore is very advanced in terms of the technology and in the administration of justice. By the way, the administration of justice is my definition of the rule of law in practice, as applied in practice. Singapore is good at this. Lots of technological advances, and they're willing to, of course, to share it. In Hong Kong, where we have a vast volume of cases and difficult cases to deal with, the administration of justice is key. And while the judiciary sometimes moves a little slower than it should, not glacial pace, but glacial melting pace, but not as quick as perhaps some other jurisdiction, it does get there in the end. But that is an improvement that was always be made. And for this, you need, of course, the government to ensure that the judiciary has enough resources, which, as I understand, certainly in my time, the government supports.
Yes, that's my understanding too. The government threw money at it. But one of the perceived problems is that it hasn't moved really quite as fast as it might in terms of being digital hearings, for example. I mean, in my side of the profession, face-to-face meetings with clients and the like are becoming quite unusual.
Well,
COVID changed everything.
Absolutely. As the judiciary brings in a new generation of younger judges, in other words, with the dinosaurs who are unable to do anything technical, disappearing from the scene, this is, of course, encouraging. It wasn't that long ago with judges who couldn't even type out anything.
And I'm not going to embarrass you by asking.
I type my own judgments or awards now.
But I was reflecting with you recently that certainly when I started my career, and you're younger than I am, of course, but when I started my career, the fax machine had not been invented.
Well, it was a brilliant invention when it came out.
I thought
it was more important than sliced bread.
Yes.
Proverbial sliced bread.
Yes, yes. I remember telephoning, in fact, a current sitting judge who was a friend of mine at the time, and saying to this gentleman, have you heard of this thing called the fax machine? And in a rather dismissive way, he said, yes, my firm has two of them. My response was, Jeff, as a Yorkshireman with Scottish blood as well, I think it's a bit expensive. We'll give it a miss. Oh, dear me. Jeff, it's been a pleasure. There are so many topics we could talk about, but because podcasts are relatively short, it's my duty now to thank you, and my pleasure is to thank you for coming along. Well, maybe we should do it again soon.
Well, thank you for inviting me again, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Well, you've covered some very interesting topics. Thank you for that.
Thank you.